Hello and welcome back to the Indie Film Toolkit Podcast. I am your host, Wade Bodrick, joined by Ben Robertson.
Hello.
And
what?
David Ishida.
What the?
He went out of order, David.
What is this? I paid you $20 to have second billing in this thing.
Yeah, well.
And you come along and then he... And,
hey, but Ben. He's so late, he's so great. And now...
Now I'm early? Yeah.
Anyway, a couple quick housekeeping things. We weren't able to put out our June episode because shortly after recording, we started production on a feature film. So we didn't have any downtime to...
We should say we... Started working on a production,
yeah.
Yes. Feature film.
So it's not our.
Yes,
this was not our.
Just want to clarify
movie.
That.
Correct. Correct. So unfortunately, we didn't have time to get that out, but we've got two episodes for July. This is episode 13. So episode 12, we saw and discussed Voice from the Stone, an indie feature made in Italy, but directed by a local filmmaker, Eric Howell. But this episode is going to be about the film we worked on all of June, and it was our first paid feature for all three of us. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that it would be great. All three of us thought it'd be great to sit down and discuss the process as a whole, because it was a big learning experience.
Absolutely.
And I think we have some things we'd like to share. Mm-hmm. Overall, good experience, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It was very solidifying for me as far as this being my career, as far as this being something that I want to do for like the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Oh, and I guess roles, Ben, you were the second assistant director.
Correct.
David, you were second AC / first AC for B-Cam.
Slash DIT.
You were three roles wrapped into one. Mm-hmm. And then I was key set production assistant. And so it was really interesting for me to witness... us having different roles and expertise in different corners of the production, and how we adapted to those roles was really interesting to me.
Yeah, and we've talked about it on the podcast before of how in most of our previous productions, we all had to fulfill many different roles. You know, especially with like Dawn, where Wade, you were director, but you were also one of the prop designers and the painters, and you did all. You were the screenwriter for it, and Ben, you were acting in it, and you were the production coordinator for it. And I was the AD and an AC and
also build
VCR
sets.
And the set builder.
Yeah, but like,
It's refreshing to now be in this production.
Oh, yeah.
Where one of the gentlemen who's the camera operator for Dan Godar, he would have to tell me like, no, stop. It's not your job to do that.
Yeah,
I would go and do something that I don't know if it's just how we've done productions or I'm just good natured or whatever, but it's like, oh, we know we need an Apple box or something.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it's way over in the truck, but I'm not doing anything. I'll go do it. It's like, no, it's not your job to do that. At this point, you know, you talk to one of the grips, it's their job. They're in charge of all that equipment.
Right.
It makes most sense
to
go through that. And, you know, it's not being rude or trying to put off something onto someone else for the sake of it, but it's a true point.
Which would make sense on a union job, right? Because in a union job, you don't even touch anybody else's stuff that's not in your department or not yours. Right?
I think even if it's not union, it's still practice to not.
Yeah, sure. I'm sure like in the union, there could be, I don't know anything about union, but who knows? Maybe there are consequences if you do. I would think in most productions, this is a common thing. You really don't need to bother yourself with things that are not in your department, in your jurisdiction,
so,
if you will.
David, did you feel like you had to, though? To step outside of your role?
No.
Yeah, because...
I did not have to. I think it was just habit.
Mm-hmm.
And just force of habit. It's like, I know that the Apple boxes are in the production, or in the grip truck. I know where they are. I can go get them. You know, so I'm fully capable of doing it. But as Dan would say, it's not my job to do it anymore.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting point to bring up. I think what we should maybe start with is what were some of our duties that we had. So Ben, like, what were your day-to-day duties?
My
second AD?
Yeah, sure.
I'm
so
Ben first now. Good grief. How much did you pay him for the second plan?
I like this. It's great.
I'm going counterclockwise today.
Dealers left, man. Dealers left. Yeah. Go on.
So each day I helped come up with the schedule. Rather, I gave opinions of what the schedule should be. And then I worked with creating the call sheets, making sure people showed up on time. If they were late, you know, call them. Otherwise, I would work on production reports either during production, like while we were filming, if I wasn't needed on set. And then if I was needed on set, it was typically because the AD was elsewhere doing something else. And so there's a couple of times where I got to call action, which was pretty sweet. But beyond that, it was a lot of like clerical stuff that I was working with the production coordinator, Christy Carrera, with So handling talent releases, getting them to sign W-9s and whatnot. A lot of that, a lot of
stuff. And getting extras.
Yeah, help secure extras or places to shoot locations. Kind of just assist our producer Dan Cummings along with with the stuff that he has to do as well. Yeah.
A lot of administrative and often unseen things that are no less important to the production.
Vital, I would say, absolutely vital.
Yeah.
For all that and yeah,
because when you get there at the start of the day. You know, people right away want sides, call sheets. They call want sheets, sides, including me. So you having to print those off every single day, either at the night for the next morning or the morning of. I bet you went through a lot of ink and a lot of paper.
Oh yeah, I went through. I actually tallied up how much I printed off. I think I printed off close to around 2,000 sheets of paper.
Oh, wow.
I went through, I think, 3 cartridges of ink.
Do you have a laser jet or an inkjet?
It's a printer.
Okay. Well, then, and sides then rolls into something that you took on, as part of your role.
Yeah, my role, which was very important. I'll get to in a minute. David, what are some of your key tools?
I had a perfect segue, and this is how you treat me. Good grief. Well, okay, I'll pay you $30 next month. I'll up it $30 next month. Am I going next?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Second AC.
I was my. Probably the main title role would be second AC. And so I am basically an assistant to the first AC, and this is a camera assistant. And I would assist in lens changes and moving stuff around and setups. But because we had a 2-camera shoot, I basically became first AC to B camera. And first AC is the focus puller. I didn't pull focus on B cam because of our setup was not conducive because we were a lot of handheld. So I didn't really pull focus ever, just because that was the easier way to do it. But I was really in charge of B camera and verifying settings and making sure everything is square across it. I also did, for the first time ever, and something I wish we'd have known about and done for Dawn, which are camera reports or camera logs.
Yes.
So I logged every single shot of the entire film for both cameras, noting what the scene was, what the shot number, the shot letter was, what lenses we were on, the stop of the lens, any filters on it, and any special notes.
I think there was one day in Dawn where Lee was there and he did a camera report, sort of.
Yeah. And for that one, though, I think, as I recall, he did it for the 3 shots we knew for sure we needed. I don't think we did it. He did it for the whole day.
Right.
But luckily for us, though, we were pretty accurately able to figure out what the... What lenses are we using? That was the big thing for visual effects, is just knowing what lens you're using. And then the last thing I did was I did what many people would call DIT. I wouldn't call it that. I would call it data wrangling. In my opinion, in my view, DIT does a lot of onset playback and live LUTs to be able to push out, which I didn't do any of that, but I was data wrangling. So at one point, and you did for Anna's Playground Wade, you were a loader, as I recall. Did you do some loading?
I didn't do that, no.
Oh. Well, I apologize.
Wait, you're talking film loading?
Yeah.
No. I was purely art department.
Okay, gotcha. At one point, one would have had a loader for film, loading and unloading the magazines of film. And I was doing the same thing, but for digital media cards. Mm-hmm. So every day we put in new media cards, and I had the nerve-wracking task of erasing them.
Yes.
Because, we cycled through about 6 different cards. And so inevitably, I think it was on day 2 that morning, I put the cards in. I said, okay, well, this is the moment where either I fired myself or everything's normal, and I erased the card. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't back it up well and it's gone, then that's no good at all.
Yeah, we just lost the shoot.
Yep. Well, so that's the stuff I was covering.
You had 2 other responsibilities that you did not mention. One of which was to hydrate Sam Fisher.
Not only Sam, but the whole camera department.
Yeah, basically the whole camera department. And then 2, to come up with ridiculous letter calls for the scenes.
Right.
They were not ridiculous.
No.
You had themed days.
Yeah, so when it started out, if people want to learn more about slating, there's a great video on Rocket Jump Film School about how to slate. And one of the things they talk about on there is a common thing is when you have a scene, we're shooting scene 13, and then we start just going shot by shot, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, J, K, L.
Not I?
No. I's and O's are always skipped.
Oh,
for my head, because they look too much like ones and zeros, and you don't want to be confusing at all to the editor. So you skip that, which I learned. Which is an official thing I learned from Alicia, who was the script supervisor / continuity.
Gotcha. And person. I feel like they say that in the video as well.
They do. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we did that. And so the other thing you do is when you read the slate, because when you call out the slate, you say the scene number and letter, the take, and then if on this a multi-camera shoot, which camera I'm marking, or both cameras. So I'd say like A camera mark and slate for there, and then move over to B camera, or I'd say A, B mark if they could both see me.
Or A only.
Or, exactly. If we were just using one camera in that moment.
Or tail slating too.
Or tail slating. That's a whole thing.
Or soft sticks.
If you're curious about all that stuff we just threw out, again, go check out the video on Rocket Jump Film School. It's really good. But yeah, so what you do for the letters is you always say most people would probably use the NATO phonetic alphabet. So you'd say 13 alpha, take one, to make it very clear for the sound guy listening what letter that you're doing. I'm not content with the NATO phonetic alphabet. And so at first I started mainly focusing on Star Trek references for it. And then after I think about the first week or so, Dan started the AB camera started doing challenges like, okay, today's going to be Stargate Day. Or this is going to be 80s and 90s movies day. And so I do that, and we rounded out with Indiana Jones as I dressed up on the last day.
Yeah, you also did a Disney day.
Yep. Oh, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That was a fun one. Yeah. I enjoyed that immensely.
Which was good. You also were challenged to do, what was the Lord of the Rings, no repeats?
Yes, mm-hmm. That one was a challenge. Any day when there was no repeats, because what I found is, at least from the nerdy things we were using for our things, is there are not a lot of C words in the world, apparently.
Hmm. Yeah.
Especially in Lord of the Rings, there are not a lot of C's.
There's like six or so.
Yeah, I'm surprised. Like, unless you like dig into super deep lore, which I was trying to avoid because I wanted to keep it somewhat knowable. Yeah. People would get the joke and whatnot. Yeah.
But there was one C that you did, because I remember talking with you about it. You said you didn't want to do
ones that I did.
You didn't want to do ones that were like multiple words long.
Yep.
And you did Coming to America.
Yep.
That's true.
Yep.
Which I was like, what? That goes against whatever.
Yep. No, I was trying to avoid that. And then after talking with Dan a little bit, just, you know, for the sake of, you know, keeping things a little peppy around set and whatnot.
Yeah.
Especially on the Disney day. Disney day was tough. I'm sure we'll talk about that later in the podcast. Mm-hmm. It was one of the days we had. It was a really tough day for everybody. And so, especially for that one, I really wanted to, you know, which make people smile for a minute.
That was the hotel.
That was the hotel.
The last one.
Yeah.
We'll get to that later, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. After talking with him, he's like, yeah, like if it's short enough, like, you know, you can get it in, you know, sort of a mouthful. And like, I just went ahead and did it. Mm. Like, I wouldn't do something like 18, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, yeah, or something like that, or yeah. The Lord of the Rings, The Englishman Who Went Up a Hill and Came Down a Mountain. okay. That's an actual movie.
Yeah, you
it's
did
a, it's
one.
A very good. Mm. No, I didn't.
I thought I heard it.
No, I said it was a joke.
Oh,
it was after this conversation about how long of a title, and said, it was like, oh yeah, you could do multi-word things. Like, oh, I'll just do the one of the longest movie titles of all time.
Gotcha. Yeah, no shortage of lengthy duties for your role. Like we said, it was kind of like a 3-in-1.
Yep, and then also though, it was all technically under one role, but many things you had to do.
As a production assistant.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's
as key production. We should be specific to say set production.
Yeah.
As well, because there are post-production PAs there are like pre-production PAs. And so this one was very specifically set.
So I was a key set PA
I was the key set PA. And there was no other way. Don't sell yourself short.
The kind of metaphor I go with is that the PAs, or at least I tried to be, was sort of the mortar to the brick of the production. Mm. Just filling in all the cracks that needed
to be
filled.
That's a very good way of looking at it. That's really nice.
No matter where they might spring up. So the beauty of what I got to do was, basically whatever random thing needed to be done at the time, at a given time. So my default position was, at the beginning of the day, I was responsible for handing out all 10 of our walkies, half to G&E, Gripen Electric, and half to production. No one on camera had walkies. No one on art had walkies. There was maybe one for hair and makeup here and there, but usually not very often.
Mm-hmm.
And once those were all handed out, I usually helped try and load/unload either art department or
crafty
or craft or hair and makeup wardrobe, and get everyone to their starting positions to start the day. Once that was accomplished, I, depending on the location, had to know where the restroom was, where lunch was going to be for later in the day, where set was, how people are being shuttled to and from set, and if that needed to be me, I would do it. if there was chance of rain, getting tents, tables, chairs set up in advance for lunch, but mostly just like tents if we needed it for camera station or hair makeup station, depending on how mobile we were. We had a home base at this couple, Ted and Rhonda's lovely log cabin up north in Minnesota.
North Branch.
And so we were able to stay stationed in their garage for a good part of the shoot. And once camera is being brought to set and they start blocking, rehearsing, ready to roll, then my kind of default position then transitions to being usually within eye shot of Robin, the first AD, and ready for anything and everything that he might call on. Usually it's him looking for someone, often someone that's right in front of him. There were quite a few times when he would have this wild, frantic look in his eye saying, "Where's Jeremy?" or "Where's blah, blah, blah?" And I learned very quickly that if I didn't already know where that person was, because one of the main things I need to do is always know where talent was, and if I could, know where every person was on set or not on set. And so if the moment that he asked, "Where is so-and-so?" to not say, "I don't know," but to help him narrow his search or spend half a second glancing around and then say, "They're right there."
Another set I want to point out to just show... And this is not to put any of us three down in any way, but just to show what I think is an interesting tidbit about how our work is. We have, so starting with Ben, who is, for the most part, you're sitting at a desk and you're working on paperwork with some occasional things. And I was just flipping through your phone, looking at the pedometer on it. And it seems, on average, it seems, over the course of production, I would say you probably did about 3 to 5 miles a day on average, in that range. I was with camera all the time, and I was averaging between 7 and 9 miles a day walking. And I know, Wade, you are even further up there. I think there was one day you pulled out and you had 15 miles.
Really?
So I would be guessing you're probably between 13 and 15 miles a day.
Yeah, that's not potentially too far off. Depending, like, I think there are some days when we were, like, at the hotel or something where it wasn't quite as much. But yeah,
yeah, and again, I think that is a, you know, that's a telling look at what production is. And, you know, as you said, you are the mortar, which I think is a very good way of looking at it. And, you know, and I think that is partially shown by simply how much you were moving around constantly. Sure. There are very few down moments for PAs.
I did adopt the you know, kind of rule of thumb of not to run on set eventually. It took me a while because I was so frantic in the beginning. Yeah. But
I called you on it. Well, actually, we should talk about that very moment since you bring it up, about not running on set.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, if someday... Someday, after Dawn Under Heaven is released, I will go through the footage and I will find all the funny clips of me running before takes. Like, there were the ones when we were filming on the opposite side of a quarry and I needed to run to get out of frame.
Yeah.
So I would have to slate, and I don't know why I was slating from the other side of the quarry. In hindsight, like, if I had to do it now, I would not be doing that. I would be slating on that particular...
That's really funny. I forgot about that. That was really hard to hear you.
Yeah. Here's a quick side tidbit for slating. The rule of thumb is, for every 10 millimeters of the lens, that's the foot away from the camera you should slate from. Sure. So if it's an 85 millimeter lens, you should be about 8.5 feet away from the lens. It's a good slating distance to have it fill the frame nicely. So again, with those, there was barely even a point.
You were like 150 feet away. Yeah, exactly. That was a long lens.
Yep. And so I would run out of frame. After I was running on set several times at the beginning of production, again by my on-set mentor, one of my on-set mentors, of Dan Godar, said, "Dude, don't run on set. You should not run on set. You move quickly. You move with a purpose. You shouldn't lollygag, but you shouldn't run on set. Running on set leads to accidents." Yeah. You know, you look up fail army videos and there's all the things of people running and, you know, slipping or, you know, jumping over a chain and catching their foot and they faceplant. You know, that's a bit extreme, I know. But yeah, you really don't need to run on set.
Right. I think the exceptions that I still had were, for example, there was a long driveway at Ted and Rhonda's, and sometimes we would be stationed at the end of the driveway, or there'd be something in someone's car at the end, so I would try and just maybe do a little jog down the driveway.
And it's understandable,
considering how many mosquitoes were in that driveway.
Yeah, you'd want
to go as fast as possible. And to be fair, like, yes, and I think that in my opinion that would be an acceptable time, and also partially because in a certain sense you're not on set. mm-hmm. is another thing. Like, it, you know, I'd never run on set proper itself. You know, there's far too many cables and things. You know, that was a big thing that became an issue at the end, especially on some of our smaller sets, is because of our setup, we had to do wired video village. Video village is a series of monitors for the director, the DP, the gaffer, the makeup artist, the continuity person,
right.
all those people to hang out and watch the feed. Because of our setup, we did not have wireless video transmission, which is something we will talk about in an upcoming podcast. But they all had to be wired. So we had to have two, you know, either 50 or 100 foot long BNC cables connecting the cameras to Village. And it was getting real hairy, especially on that Disney day, the hotel day. That one was really tight.
Yeah.
And there was some tripping happening because of those cables. And some of it was my fault. I should have been paying closer attention. Sometimes it's like, you know, accidents happen.
Yeah,
and, you know, absolutely. Sometimes it can't be helped.
But just to kind of cap off some of the duties I had, because I obviously went into great detail about the start of the day. Basically, my mindset was to just be like an open hand mm-hmm. on set. And if anyone needed to hand off anything, I would take it, whether it be trash or mm-hmm. something had to move, if we had to strike something. Mm-hmm. So if art department had to like reset a room or completely
flip a set or
move something out of set that wasn't supposed to be there. I would categorize my default mindset as potential energy transitioning mm-hmm. to kinetic energy, like always mm-hmm. ready on standby to mm-hmm. to jump in and do something. The great part about being always on the sidelines ready to jump in was that I was able to work with Genie, art, and camera almost consistently every day, whether mm-hmm. it was wrangling cables for camera or helping, you know, Genie move their stuff. I never set up any lights or stands, but, you know, sometimes maybe I'd help them tie one of the blackout curtains on a window or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, yeah, grabbing apples or apple boxes or things like that. And then art, I think the second or third day we had to use a whiskey bottle prop that was using a label that we had made, our art director had made. And he needed like a semi gloss finish on it to make it look a little more convincing. So he'd asked me to kind of maybe if I could cover up some of the glass. And he came back 10 minutes later and I'd completely taped off every inch of the glass, exactly what it was. And he goes, "Oh, wow." And it was a lot of the Don training of doing that.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was remarkably informative to be able to work with every department for more or less every department, and to know everyone on set, because I had to. If someone if Robin asked, "Where is Melissa? We need her right now," or "Where's, you know, Abby?" or "Where, you know," all these people that I had to memorize their names, know them personally, be able to point mm-hmm. where they were. It was a lot of balls to juggle at once, and it was very stressful to learn. But once I got the hang of it, it was a lot of fun. And I will say, one of the biggest things I learned about being a key set PA is that it's a very privileged position to be able to, you know, assist the production in whatever small ways that I could. There were some times when, like, I don't know, I would ask people if they wanted coffee, and then be like, "Oh, you don't have to do that," treating it like it was just some small, like, trivial thing that they wouldn't want anyone to do. And my thought was like, no, absolutely not. It is my duty and honor to provide you mm-hmm. with this sustenance to get you through the shoot.
I'll say this for anyone who may be listening who knows this person. I don't think either of you have had the privilege of meeting one of my favorite people in the world, Matt Kendall. He is a career PA.
I've heard about him, actually.
Yep, he is a PA in the area. I don't know how old, you know, he's much older than us. No offense, Matt, if you're listening. But he is the most unbelievable person. He is like you in so many ways, like that. Like, he's always there to give a hand. One of the great things he did at Cinequip for us when I was working there is if there's extra food and he's on set, he'll always ask production, "Hey, can I get CQ's people in on this?" And he makes sure and comes every single person at Cinequip. So we don't, you know, or obviously we're there filming there, but, you know, other than that, we don't have a connection with the production. And he comes and lets us know that he's at. Apparently, he always has candy in his car. And always some snacks in his car. So if he's ever doing runs or picking up actors, he always has food and drink for them in his car.
That's
if
amazing.
He's having to shuttle people around.
That's amazing.
He is an unbelievably amazing human being.
Yeah.
And so I again, it's somewhat lost on you because you have not met him, but He has that exact mindset.
That's great.
Is how he treats it. He takes a job incredibly seriously, and it shows.
Yeah.
It really shows.
Like it really does make a difference to anticipate people's needs. I know that can be hard to figure out how to do initially, but an example was we needed, I think it was the shoot with at the auto body shop or the mechanic shop, and Alicia asked me for a chair for Village, for the director. Mm-hmm. And if someone typically asked me for something, I grabbed two, just in case. So I came up with two chairs, and that worked out because both he and his wife wanted to sit down. Mm-hmm. So just like if someone asked me for something, I'd try and get more than needed. I also, I was dressed like an AC because I had that CinemaBakes pouch and a bunch of tape. But I used both those things very consistently throughout the set. Mm-hmm. A lot of people came up and needed tape from me, or I would just need it to help art, like get some cables out of the way or something. And then in my pouch, I kept things like a knife, utility knife, a razor, bug spray, which came really in handy because people need bug spray, and I had it right there every single time. Mm-hmm. I had some
advice for people going into filmmaking. Don't get the BS family bug spray. Get like the DEET 60 or whatever
it is.
Like the off woods, the woods, the dark green off woods. I think that
was
raid.
That was 25% DEET. I had the 15% the first few days. Anyway,
get the good stuff.
I had extra sides and call sheets with me. I would typically find people's sides they had left lying around. I would put them in my pouch and have them ready for them. I also held cell phones for talent while they were in a scene, gave them back once the scene ended. And I can't tell you how many times someone asked me to do something and I needed what was in my pouch immediately to do it. So like, for example, the last day of shooting, we were dealing a lot with rope and we were trying to get the right setup with all this rope. I was tying off a knot for the scene, and Sam, the DP, looked at a frayed end and said, cut that and burn it, get rid of it. And so I needed a razor immediately, and I had one, sliced it. I didn't have a lighter, unfortunately, but Robin was right there and he smoked, so we handed it him to me. Mm-hmm. So within 10 seconds I had fulfilled that
request. You should always have a lighter on
and
set.
And if you
had one, but there's no oil in it, so it was gonna be useless.
I will say, as a PA, the three vital things are walkie, which you'll probably be assigned, but also a roll of tape and a barker. Those are the three big things. I obviously had much more, and I would recommend having a kit because it's good to be prepared for the stuff.
Absolutely. Like that. And let's go on with that. So Ben, what was your absolutely needed accessories on set for what you were doing?
For what I was doing, a couple different Sharpies, a couple different pens, cause you lose those things or people take them.
Yeah, you do.
I have
except mine. Mm-hmm. I guard my pens. Yeah. I like my pens. They are good pens. They write nicely. They get a lot of writing out of them. If I hand you a pen, believe me, I am watching you, and I'm getting my pen back.
You still have your space pen?
Oh no!
I don't know where it went. I'm really concerned about that.
Besides the point,
I've learned to start marking them. I think that I'm gonna like mark them with tape, so I make sure I know like which pens are mine or whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I have clipboards, or my one clipboard.
I want to point out though, what is special about your clipboard?
Oh, that it opens.
It opens.
Oh yeah.
That I think is a big thing.
Yeah, your clipboard's sweet. How much was it?
I think it was like $12-13 on Amazon.
So we're saying it opens. So if you opened it, like it was probably about three quarter of an inch thick. So you could just fit a lot of extra pages in there. I know you often kept sides in there because sides, as they're done on movie sets, are not full size sheets of paper for the script. They are half pieces, mm-hmm. gone long ways because they're small. You fold them up, stick them in your pockets fast, mm-hmm. and so you can fit almost all of them in there quite nicely.
Yeah, except for like the really long days when they got like really thick.
But I really appreciated that the sides were that size. Like, could you imagine if the sides were full sheets? That would be miserable.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
It was so nice that they were that small size. Anyway, yep.
So my clipboard, a couple different pens. What else? My laptop. I use that a lot to try to get like work done during the set when I wasn't needed to do the other stuff, and then my phone. I use my phone often because when we were in the middle of nowhere, it ended up being like the company's like hotspot for internet or for whatever.
That's right. Yeah, Christy was like, "Go get Ben. I need his phone for internet."
That's another thing to point out too. With that is something to consider if you are going into freelance world or something like this. Is you will probably be using a lot of data. It's probably reality.
Yeah.
Up until this point, I have been very fortunate in that every job I have worked has had Wi-Fi. So I would go to work and I have Wi-Fi, and I would go home and I had Wi-Fi. So I used very, very little data. Like I would go through some months and maybe only have used 500 or 600 megs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically to do some like brief searches when I'm out and about or like a GPS kind of thing. But yeah, at this point it's like, I now, you know, like on these, like 5 days a week for probably about 12 hours, I was out of at a place with no Wi-Fi at all. So I used a lot more data than I normally would have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, sorry, what are the other things?
I think it was just like my binder folders are basically stuff I could put like actor releases in and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. beyond that, like it feels kind of dumb because like a lot of my stuff just feels really kind of like office equipment, a bunch of office. And I start getting like nerdy about my office equipment. I'm like, oh, no. Check out this stapler. It's real.
No, right. Absolutely. Cool, yeah. Cool. Because yeah, like you want the best stapler that can do the job. You just want, mm-hmm. you don't want the shitty cheap stapler.
Absolutely. You know? I noticed a definite change in me over the course of probably the past about 5 years or so is like, I just wait and buy the nicer thing than get the cheap thing that just gets the job. Unless, you know, in a pinch, it's whatever. But I mean, like, mm-hmm. I just wait and get the nicer thing.
And to the point of the office equipment, I think it was Robin who had that mini shelf thing.
Yeah.
And that was great because it stored a lot of useful items. Like, mm-hmm. there was a bunch of highlighters, and there were several times when talent would ask me for highlighters for their sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't carry on any on me. I probably should have, but I would come to the production table and, you know, get it there. Yeah. So, yeah, it was great that production, yeah, had all that handy office stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
David, what's in your kit? What do you carry with you?
Well, at some point, what I want to do, and I might do it next week or something when I have some free time, because I think it would be cool. And maybe actually I'll have you guys come over and help me with this. But I wanted to do a not as fancy as some people do, but a stop motion unpacking of my kit bag.
Okay.
Like animate all the things coming out of it.
Sure.
Because what's in my kit bag is a ton of stuff. But again, going with my essentials, the essentials I had on me that were on my belt that I had to have at any given moment is I had my tape stringer. Like Wade had, mainly I was four different colors of paper tape and one white gaff. White gaff because I do a lot of marking of things I need to write on it. So that's why I don't use black gaff very often. On that stringer, I did have it around, but not on my stringer. And then paper tape because the other thing the second AC does is marks, laying down marks for actors. So if they know they need to hit a certain mark, I put a T mark or some kind of mark on the ground for them so they can hit their mark. And that also helps the first AC hit the focus because they should be at a fixed point in space.
Right.
doesn't always happen though.
Can you explain to me what paper tape is? Is it not just gaff tape? Because no. I remember I bought paper tape at like an Ace for the production and it didn't have any adhesive.
It was the wrong kind of paper tape.
But it said paper tape. So I was like,
yes, this must be no, you're absolutely right. And so with this kind of paper tape, think of it as like painter's paper tape, but not shit.
Yeah, it does remind me of good tape. Like those rolls of blue painter tape, but actually it sticks.
Good kind.
And doesn't tear super easily.
Yeah. So that one is useful because it's for like, you know, for marking things on the ground for people. Like it needs to be something that goes down easy and comes off easy. Gaff tape is too good at that. You know, if you put, like, I can put paper tape on a carpet and it will be fine. You put gaff tape on a carpet and you're going to end up probably starting to tear the carpet.
Yeah.
So that was on my tape stringer, and then then the other thing I had with me that was vital is I had a flashlight, which was incredibly important. I do need to get a small flashlight because my flashlight is a pretty powerful one. I actually, oddly enough, need one that's weaker because this one is too bright at times. So I need like a little tiny, like one LED pen light, something really small and simple. But I had a flashlight. I had a rocket blower, which is this little, you know, squeeze blower thing that you use to blow off lenses and camera stuff. Because you don't use compressed air right on cameras and that kind of thing for the most part. That I had lens cleaner of some kind. I usually had a microfiber on me, and I had other lens cleaning stuff in my kit.
Did you use the microfiber to clean both lenses and the eyepieces?
I won't use a microfiber on a lens because microfibers, while they're nice for glasses and stuff, they can, because they can, you know, it's still a cloth, it can get stuff in it, so it can scratch lenses. Yep. So I will only use microfiber on non-essentials like my glasses and like the EVF on the camera.
Mm-hmm.
For lenses, you use lens tissue, which is guaranteed not to scratch. Which the lens tissue won't, but again, if there's dirt or something already on the lens or whatever,
right? Then so that's why you'd probably start with the blower to maybe remove any of that.
Exactly. Yep.
Gotcha. And did you carry the lens tissues on you or in your bag?
My lens tissues, no, they were in my bag, but my bag followed me everywhere.
Yeah.
So my bag was probably never more than about 30 feet away from me, or from away from cameras. So it was not usually a huge thing to stop and grab that. What was the other one other big thing? I also had a multi-tool like you did, Wade, mm-hmm. and also a flathead screwdriver because that gets used a lot. And then The other vital thing for me was dry erase markers. I had 3 or 4 dry erase markers and also a couple of Sharpies.
And your slate, you always carried that around too.
Yes. Yeah, for the most part. With the slate, the difficult thing is there's no good place to put a slate anymore. Back in the day, there was a thing called a front box, which would be mounted up on a tripod, and there would be a slot for your slate, and so you'd just stick it in there, because you don't want the slate to leave camera. Though I'm the person that's usually doing all the slating, you never want it to leave camera in case they need to start shooting when you're not there. You never want to be lost without it, so you usually leave it right, you know. Usually when I wasn't carrying it, I would lean it against one of the tripod legs and put it there. So it's always around. But there were a few times I accidentally walked off.
That, and even if we did have a front box, like, the film was mostly handheld anyway.
It's true. But I mean, it was on, we did usually have the tripods with us, because that's where we would drop cameras. So it would still be sort of close. But again, with modern tripods, with how small they are, they can't fit a front box the way, in the same kind of front box that they used to have.
Sure.
You can go to Google, just look up images of like camera front boxes.
I loved like the setup you had on your slate, because it was a beefy thing. You had not only the slate with all the tape on it, with all like the, you know, the names and all that stuff. You also had on the back of it, you know, your book of the lens
camera
reports.
Logs.
The camera log.
Yep. So on the front, and usually what I will do in the future, because I will be buying one, is I'm going to get a label maker. And so like with slates, like a lot of people, like what I've seen, especially for smaller, like new coming indie productions, like people out of film school, or people in film school, is they write everything in dry erase marker. Now, that's fine for the first time you slate it, but then as soon as you take that slate and stick it under your arm to do something with, you've erased half your slate. So what I did, and what a lot of people do, is you either use a label maker, or I just put white gaff tape on the important things, things that would never change. The title of the film is never going to change. The director is never going to change. It's going to be the same all the time. So that gets written in white gaff in permanent marker, because it's always there. And then I would cycle out things like the date would be cycled in and out. excuse me. And on the back, as you were saying, so I had a clip that had my camera logs, because I would have to have two logs going all the time, one for A camera and one for B camera. And then I also had, I had spare camera reports, so I didn't have to go back to my bag to get new ones when a page filled up. And then I would also have stickers on the back for some of the variants. So I had one sticker that was for 48 frames per second when we were doing off frame rate. So then that would get moved onto the front. I had markers for when we were only A camera, only B cam. And there were also inside the booklet thing that was on the back, which we didn't end up using, because we didn't use a lot of filtration. There's also a big list of filters. So you could stick those onto the front of the slate or onto the matte box itself, depending on how you're doing things, to mark what's in the matte box.
Yeah.
Well, and you also had the LED light on as well.
That thing was fun. Yeah, as a gift, Sam threw everyone in the DP, gave everyone in the camera department this fun little like clip light that had two snake lights on it. And what worked out perfectly for me is I would have one snake light going to the back to light up my report when I needed to write when we were doing night scenes. And then the other snake head going to the front to illuminate the front of the slate in night scenes. You know, if it's really dark, you can't see the slate. And it's also great because it doesn't, because I did have my flashlight. I could have done it with that, but then I would have one hand for flashlight, one hand for the slate.
Right, exactly.
And with this way, I kept one hand free, or if I needed to do a slate with two hands.
Yeah. And you also, I think, really perfected the art of one-hand slating.
I wouldn't say perfected, but I got really good at it. Yeah. I got a lot better. Yeah, it was a challenge, and basically for a long time, I think for most of Dawn, I think I did, for the most part, I did two-handed slating. So that's when I would have one hand on the top of the clapper and one hand holding the bottom, keep it stable. And then at some point in Dawn, I had gotten the idea, because I saw someone else doing it, where they made a little gaff tape loop in the middle of the top clapper, so you can slide your thumb into there, and you can click it that way. It makes life easier. And then thanks to tutelage from Erica, who was the first AC for the majority of production, and Dan, I learned how to be better at single-handed slating without any of the tape on there.
Yeah.
Which is still, I'm still not perfect at, because you have to try and keep the information half as still as possible and bring the top half down. But when you squeeze it, you want to lift the bottom up.
And one of the things,
we can do a video about that sometime.
Yeah, one of the things that I really liked were when we were doing shoots with, say, an uncooperative dog character, and also when we were waiting for sun and the clouds to hit the light just right, where there was no time to slate, we had to just roll, and then you'd get a tail slate.
Yep. So tail slate is when, excuse me, is when you slate at the end of a clip rather than the beginning, and you basically say it exactly the same way, except you turn the slate upside down. And you slate upside down, and that's the editors know very clear. That's a big thing with that kind of thing. You want to be very clear about how you're getting information to the editors, because, like for this one, the editor's not on set. The editor doesn't know what we were doing in a given moment. On there, and so you want to make it as absolutely clear as possible for him, and also for the sound engineer as well, because the sound guy doesn't have a visual, so I have to vary it. So for the sake of video, it's upside down, and then for the sake of audio, you have to say tail slate, or second sticks if I messed up. Like there were a few times I pinched my fingers in the slate, and then instead of a clear clack of the slate, it was a something pointless. So you have to say second sticks, and you slate again, and that's when they know that that's what they should be using as their mark.
Yeah, speaking of the sound guy, Jeff Delorier.
Awesome guy.
Yeah,
he's amazing.
He's a super nice guy, very good at what he does, and he has so many cool gadgets, so many cool sound gadgets.
I still think sound guys have the coolest gear. They're decked out for war.
I felt bad for him, though, because he was a one-man sound department.
Show, yeah, we didn't
and
have
that
a boom
can be
off.
That can be very tricky. There were a couple times I did boom for him. It was the funniest time was when we were shooting the last day by the ravine before everyone else came out, before lunch. And I not only slated for you because you weren't there.
And didn't fill out my camera parts, right?
Well, we can go into that. But I will say I just followed the log that was already done. And you can blame Sam because he was slating before me.
I'll blame whoever I want.
Anyway, I slated, and then immediately after slating, I was holding boom. So it was quite the interesting thing. And also, we didn't have bug spray at the time, so I got like 8 million bites. So I was trying to hold the boom as steady as I could. Anyway, but yeah, Jeff had so many cool gadgets, and sometimes he would be in a completely different room monitoring a bunch of different lavs and his boom, which was being held up by a C-stand. And it was really impressive to see what kind of gear he had and how he used it. And it was really impressive to see all the departments. Hair and makeup had a lot of great stuff that they did in this film. There was fake vomit being made by Melissa, who was the...
That stuff was gross looking. Apparently it tasted okay.
Well, yeah, I think it was made with soup.
Was it soup? Maybe, yeah, no, you're right. I think there was a soup base to it. Yeah. Like, there were some other things that would have made it, like, it wouldn't taste great, but it's not like you were, like, having to put, like, Vaseline and
vegetable
oil. Actual
vomit that comes out with the fake vomit.
There were a lot of things that I learned how to do on the set. I'd never driven a big truck with the trailer before, so I did that.
I don't envy you.
Well, I mean, it was fine. I didn't crash or hit anything, so that worked. There was so many things that I probably wouldn't want to try in real life that I just did because there was no other choice than to just do it because I was asked to. And feeling that pressure on set, like you throw yourself into a lot of situations that you try things for the first time and hope it works out. But anyway, just to wrap up, biggest takeaways for you guys for this film.
Well, before we wrap up, I feel like there are two days? Oh, there's two other things that I feel like I want to touch on real quick. One of them is making sure when you're going out, especially the locations, you are prepared for the location you're going to. We knew we were going up north. We knew there were going to be mosquitoes.
Yeah.
But one thing we learned very quickly is the overabundance of a particular plant. Poison ivy.
That's right. Forgot about that.
And sometimes you can take every precaution you think you can, and you still get hit. As Ben did.
Yeah.
Our fallen brother.
Wait, what day did that happen?
That I got the poison ivy?
Yeah.
I don't know. I woke up, I think, the last Wednesday, which was like 2 or 3 days away from the last day, with this like small like little spot, which I thought at the time was just like a bite mark from a tick. But then like kind of grew bigger and bigger. Like at first it was only like maybe like 2 inches long, and now it's probably about a foot long on my side.
I think it's more than a foot.
Really?
I think so. I think it's probably about 16 inches.
It's pretty bad. It doesn't itch, but it hurts. And I just have bad reactions with
that's
poison
rough,
ivy
man.
In general.
That's rough.
The tricky part with poison ivy is that you never really know when you're going to get it, because I wasn't like really. I was around some of like the plants a little bit here and there, but I made a particular point to stay away from it. But that oil can get on everything.
Yep.
And I noticed
that
G&E started like wearing gloves on their hands, and I know that Dan Godard, he got some poison ivy on his
ankle early on.
So that's one thing I would say is like keep in mind that everything can have it, especially if something's just like laying down on the ground for a little bit. So
and also with like poison ivy, as I recall, if you wash it off with an oil-based soap of some kind. I think you have like 4 or 5 hours to wash it off before it actually starts reacting. So you'll be aware of those things. So that, you know, that just comes into like, know where you're going, and if you need to bring a change of clothes or zip off pants or long socks or a spare of all of the above, it's a good idea. Always pack extra socks. That should be an essential in everyone's kit. Yeah. It's like 2 or 3 extra pairs of socks, because you know you can deal with wet pants and wet shirts, but you don't have to deal with wet socks. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Other thing I wanted to touch on real quick, because I think it was a big thing, was Disney Day.
Yes.
Because Disney Day was a very, 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 very challenging day for us. I would say it's probably the most challenging day of the whole shoot. There was a lot that had to happen. There were a lot of people around.
In a tight space that got very warm.
Again, I won't go into too many details because their production and whatnot. But we were filming in a hotel room. There were a lot of people in the room. And I just wanted to touch on very quickly, I know we're coming to the end of things, how each of us felt about that and how we handled it and moved on, or maybe how we wish we could have handled it better. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I know I have a story like that, because I know, again, we all experienced this day very differently. Mm-hmm. Because Ben, you were doing a lot of production stuff, but then you were also having to wrangle a ton of extras and deal with a bunch of extras a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Wade, you were having to do all your normal paid PA duties in hallways that were 3 feet wide or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I was, you know, in the midst of the room with cameras, in the camera department. So I just wanted to touch on.
Sure. So I think the biggest struggles with me was that I was by myself. There was nobody else that was down there with me. We didn't really have a really solid, reliable form of communication between myself and everyone upstairs, because you guys were on the 26th floor.
Yeah. So when you say down there, you were in the lobby with the extras. Correct, waiting. Yeah. We were up on the 26th floor.
There was no room for the extras to be up with us.
No. And while we had walkies, I think we did a test in the beginning part of the day. It wasn't, I guess, very reliable. There were times when you could hear us talking to you, but we couldn't hear your reply. So there was some confusion there, a little bit of frustration, with the communication.
Yeah, I think the way that I could have handled it better was just simply to ask for help sooner.
Yeah.
With all that I had to do with either managing the hotel people, which were giving us crap, or the extras running off and going doing their own things, or just me trying to do all of my duties, like getting people's signatures, making sure forms are filled out correctly. I should have asked for help, and I didn't. And I think that was one thing that I could have done better. And I think people should do is, like, when you're in a tough situation, know when you should ask for help, because no one's going to fault you for asking for help.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I also should point out with this day, our call time on this day was
noon.
Well, for like half the production.
Yeah. So for all of us, all three of us were there at noon. When we all had to be there. Mm-hmm. And we wrapped out at like,
it was close to 2 a.m.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Something like that. And then, you know, a bit longer for us to get home. So this was a long day, pretty much. In a certain way, not really legally speaking, it's not illegal, but for the most part, most productions try to keep it to a 12-hour day at the most. And so we were riding over that little bit, not so much after you take away the half hour for lunch.
It was a very long, I'd say probably, the longest day.
Yeah, and as I said, call was noon, so this was, a lot of this was at night, so it was also getting late as well.
But just to kind of set the premise a little more, it was not only the longest day of the production, it was maybe the slowest moving once we got into the hotel.
Yep.
We cut a lot from the call sheet for what we had planned. We didn't do any of the stuff that was scheduled for the lobby or the taxi, but even staying in the one room in the hotel suite, it moved very slowly.
Mm-hmm.
A good chunk when we first got there was sitting around waiting.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think because we got there a touch early, or there was some reason why we couldn't do anything for the first hour or so that we
were in. Yeah, I'm not sure on that one. And the other challenge that we run into is that we were constantly under the gun for time for the whole day, because not only is production trying to keep it to a 10 or 12 hour day for the sake of everybody, but also we got into the hotel room and there were a bunch of scenes that had to happen during daylight.
Yep.
And, you know, and up here at this point, sunset was around 8:30 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to constantly run to try and get everything that needed to be daytime, because, you know, if we're in a house, you can fake daytime at night because you can put a light outside the window. When we're on the 26th floor, you can't put a light outside the window.
Right.
So you can't fake daytime at night in a hotel room like this. And then
there were actor restrictions as well, as far as how long they could be on set. And
mm-hmm. we still even went beyond those, the outs that they had, and they stayed late. Mm-hmm. There was one that was 10
p.m. Which is awesome for them.
Yeah.
It was very, very good of them to be able to do that. And then after then sunset, then we just had had the bulk of the scenes that had to be at night in this big party, and there were constant changes to the setup that we had to do. Lights mm-hmm. had to move, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I will say it is hard. I wasn't in the middle of the setup, so I don't really know where a lot of the obstacles were coming from, whether it was anyone's particular indecision that we were waiting on in charge of the scene or what. But I do know that it was really hard on like the extras who arrived and waited 6 hours.
God, I feel so bad for them.
But 6 hours until they were even called to like be in the scene.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was a little rough. And especially because there weren't adequate craft services where they were waiting.
Yeah.
No, because there couldn't be. Like we had some craft in there, sure. But it was where we were hanging out was technically considered a restaurant. And so I was told that we couldn't have food there, so we had to get rid of that. And then by the time they actually got called up, people were starting to I think some of the other hotel service were coming around to ask for people's IDs because after a certain point, like at 9, it becomes like kind of like a bar you have to be 21 or older to be down there. Which we had some extras who were also underage or who were under 21, so that made things a little difficult too.
And that's some of that conflict that David nor I had to deal with, so that's some added stress. Yeah. Mm-hmm. To your position, Ben.
Yeah, that's another big thing.
I add ibuprofen to my essential
kit. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, you absolutely should have ibuprofen. And the other thing that I will be adding is anti-itch cream. I don't need to because I'm not allergic to poison ivy.
David, what were some of your...
I don't know if you had other things. Like, anything that you...
You
could convey on to the viewers, like how do you handle a day like this when we are tired? It is very hot because we have to turn off the AC while we film because the AC makes too much noise for sound. So we could only turn on AC in between scenes, which is not enough to cool down the room.
Yeah.
Small space. You had to run around and find people in a weird labyrinth of the space.
I was feeling pretty good. And then around midnight, so about 12 hours into the day, I hit a wall and my mood just drastically shifted. And I am a little disappointed in myself because I let my professional demeanor slip a little bit. And I would say if you reach a point where you hit a wall because the day is going long and you're frustrated, try not to say anything. Just be quiet and do your job.
Yeah. Or you may even, like, I've heard this reference, I believe, on some Film Riot videos a long time ago. But sometimes I think this would apply in this situation, but especially if you're in a situation where you are doing something that is potentially dangerous. And if you need a break, you should probably tell someone, it's like, I need 10 minutes to like go find a corner and curl up in a ball and sleep for 10 minutes or just 10 minutes to sit down and collect yourself. As Ben said, there's no harm in asking for help. You know, it's totally possible they could say no. It's like, no, you can't leave set right now. Mm-hmm. You're needed or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think making sure you take care of yourself, you don't want to hurt yourself or hurt other people. That kind of thing.
Yeah. Or tell your AD and your producer too, because it's also their job to make sure everybody stays safe.
Yep, exactly. Right. Exactly.
For you?
For me, it was a crazy day. So I was in the midst of the hotel roomies. I was with camera and the camera department people. And it was constantly having to, you know, disconnect cameras from the cables to Video Village, move Video Village, wrangle cables. My big failure for the day is... in the sidetrack of trying to keep in mind all this stuff about the cameras or the lenses that were on, what are the stops at, what take we're on, what needs to happen next, I let the cables get a little out of hand on the floor. And it tripped up one of the camera operators a little bit. And he got a little annoyed with me. And I think rightly so. I should have been paying more attention. That was a failing on my part. And after that... For me, then it just came zeroing in to like checklist in my brain. What am I in charge of? What do I need to watch? And just checking every one of those things all the time. After that, not a single person tripped on the cable. That was in any way my fault. There one person did trip, but it's because they were not listening when I said, watch the floor. There's cables because I was in the process of cleaning up the cables.
Gotcha.
It just became like hyper-focused on what needs to be done next. What do I need to be doing right now in this given moment?
Yeah.
That's how I dealt with that.
So overall, I'd say I know I had a blast.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
The first 2 days, it was a Thursday, Friday. The Thursday was the first day, and then we were coming back on Monday to do our first full week, and I thought, man, this is going to be so stressful and so much work. How are we going to get through our first full week? And then we did, and I was like, that was awesome. And now I feel like it just flew by.
Yeah.
Like, where did it go? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now
and
it's done.
Yeah, for me, because I left my full-time day job, like you did as well. Wait, if I may say so.
You may.
Thank you. After I said it, you could have edited it. It would have been fine. I left my full-time day job to do this because this is the kind of thing that I want to be doing. And for me, in the weeks leading up to me leaving my old job and in the week before the filming actually started when I was off, it was this sort of constant wave back and forth of like, this is so exciting, this is amazing, and then why am I leaving a good paying day job that is secure right now, and why don't I wait another year or something, and back and forth and back and forth, and then day one on set, and I'm like, this is exactly what I should have done. This is what I want to be doing. My old job was fantastic. I loved it. I loved the people there. I loved working there. This is what I want to do, mm-hmm. and I'm so happy that I made the choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Ben, what about you? You feel good?
I feel happy that I chose to get laid off for this job.
Yeah, we were coming up. Ben was driving us to set, and then he gets a call from his employer.
Yeah.
And then it was one of those calls, like, I don't know if you knew, but as soon as they said, like, hey, it's me and HR, I'm like, fuck.
Well, I thought they were like canceling my PTO or like my vacation.
That was a brief moment, but I'm like, oh no.
And then yeah. Ben pulled over, and we kind of got out of the car, and then Ben says, so you're laying me off? And David and I look at each other. We go, oh, let's walk away. Walking away.
The cop pulls up behind me. He's like, are you okay? Yeah, I'm just on the phone with my employer getting laid off.
And what's so funny is Ben likes to drive really fast to set. And I think we might have passed Dan and Robin at one point.
They drove by.
Yeah.
And they pulled up behind. Yeah.
Well, no. Before that on the freeway. And what happened was they saw a cop whiz by in the freeway. And they go, oh. Betty's going to go pull over Ben, and then they see a cop with Ben, like, oh shit. that was unfortunate for you.
Yeah, but I think it's more of just the universe kind of like pushing me in a direction mm-hmm. where I feel like I've been wanting to go for a while, and I've been mm-hmm. pretty unhappy at that job for years even. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like shitty timing, but I'm glad that I'm going in that direction. That's because that's where I want to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, to wrap it up, we had a great time on this film, and we're going to be doing a lot more film work in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I also want to do a quick shout out. Thanks to everyone in the camera department. Just everyone on production.
Yeah.
Because it was a fantastic learning experience.
Absolutely.
And I learned so much, and it was fantastic being around so many amazing people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And thanks to Dan Cummings for hiring us too.
Dan Cummings was the man. He brought us on this film.
Yeah.
We met him a few years back when he was based in Minneapolis. We rented a workspace from him, and now he's stationed out in LA, and he's just one of the coolest chill producers you'll work with.
Yeah.
so that he was great to work with. And so stay tuned to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. We will, now that we are officially all full-time filmmakers, we are going to be trying our hardest to keep talking about the latest and greatest in tools and tech and theory and
maybe
art,
more
takes
often
on movies. Yep, maybe yeah. more often. Maybe more often.
I've been wanting to say I love podcasting. I think we should do it more than once a month.
We'll get a beautiful soundproof room like we saw on set one day.
That's right. What I was gonna do if I had time. I was going to put blankets over our little recording spot in my dining room right now to give you put a few little mood candles in the middle, burn down the place with a blanket overhead.
Yeah, because it is a little echoey now. But there's a lot more to talk about that we'll get into in future episodes. For example, I just bought a Mavic Pro, so we can talk more about drones. But
he won't stop talking about it, so why would it be different on the podcast?
We'll hopefully be back sooner than a month, but we'll see how it goes. Thank you for listening to the Indie Film Toolkit podcast. We'll be back next time.